Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center. I'm excited today to have my conversation with Senator Dan McKay on the right.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
And Councilwoman Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in.
So
work hard and be nice. That's her t-shirt today.
I wore it just for you, Dan.
I wanted to start the show, you two, by just reflecting for just a few minutes on the terrible explosion in Lebanon, capital city, Beirut. I grew up knowing this as the Paris of the Middle East. You've probably heard that comment before. My son was there with some friends two summers ago. He was the first to send me an email just feeling the pain of this community, this city, this world city that, in a sense, lost its port, lost over 100 lives. The carnage, the damage will still come out over the next couple of days. But Dan, where were you when you heard this news, and what were your initial thoughts?
Well, I was sitting here at my desk, actually, and a video popped up on Twitter. And I was like, oh, what's that? And that was the first thing I saw. It was the very first video of anything that came out. Somebody put it on Twitter. And I was like, oh, wow. And then it became this barrage. But at first, it's hard to be in that moment when you see an explosion like that. And I don't know that we've ever seen as much cell phone video coverage of an explosion like this. But the video is so humbling and impressive, and makes you feel so small when you see something like that happen.
So true. So true. I one time was carted out into the West Desert on some tour where the army was getting rid of a bomb, and they let it off in the West Desert, and you got to watch it from a safe distance. That was nothing compared to what we just saw in Beirut. And, Shireen, I'm sure you have a lot of feelings here. This was an economy that was already in a free fall. Just your quick thoughts, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I will say it was just anxiety producing watching that video and thinking about what exactly was happening, what had caused it. It sounds like at this moment an accident. I think there's a lot to be learned in this, in what exactly happened in this space. But it seems like also an ammonium nitrate explosion next to a fireworks factory, unbelievable. And just to see the death toll and the devastation on top of, as you mentioned, a pandemic, a economy in free fall, a place that's already struggling.
Yeah. Just to transition to this mixed week for President Trump, and when I saw some of the initial coverage, I had a little bit of a heartache because I felt less able as an American citizen to lend aid because we're in such a fit ourselves. And I just want to put that emotion out there. But I think it was kind of a mixed week for Trump. I mean, he signed the conservation bill. That was a big deal. Dan, you know more about what he's done on limiting drug costs. But then he doubled down on the well-wishing of this Ghislaine Maxwell. Am I saying her name right, Shireen?
I think it's Ghislaine. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Ghislaine Maxwell, the known child sex trafficker. And then he also did this Axios interview with Jonathan Swan that a lot of people are going to be watching. He called Dr. Birx pathetic. But after all that, the thing that's really caught our eye on both sides of the aisle is when the president suggested delaying the November election and took on his attacks of vote by mail. And I just would love, Shireen, to hear some of your quick thinking about a vote by mail in Utah. We're one of only five states that are pretty much completely vote by mail.
Yes, and I think it's important to also note that these allegations of voter fraud really don't have a lot of evidence across this nation. In fact, the last time that we saw a really big voter fraud issue was, I believe, in North Carolina, a Republican candidate who had an employee who was well known for ballot harvesting. It was a real problem. That is a very, very, very rare occurrence. And in Utah, we actually have such a successful program that I'd reached out to the Sherry Swenson, our Salt Lake County clerk, to get some numbers on exactly what's happening with our ballots. How many ballots are being cast out? How many are not counted? So in this last primary, 186,708 ballots came in. Of those, only 1,822 were not eligible to be counted, about half of those had invalid postmarks. So they came in after they had to be postmarked by election day. That was a change that I thought a good change that the legislature made. But if they were sent in after that, they were invalid. But there were 15 envelopes that were sent in empty. Not okay, people. Make sure that you put your ballot in. You got to get it in there. And you also can't put two in one. So there were five envelopes that had two ballots in one envelope. That's also not okay. So outside of that, then there were about 1,000 that had signatures that didn't match. Now, the nice thing about Salt Lake County, the really exciting thing, and I've actually helped with this process a little bit, is that they do send out an affidavit within 24 hours, and you can sign it and get it back and have your ballot counted. So we had ballots that had mismatches of signatures. Affidavits were sent out, they were returned, and those ballots were counted. But you need to have that signature. You want that signature to match. In Salt Lake County, in Utah, you can track your ballot. And so when you get that ballot in the mail, I think it's important, especially as we're seeing some of the attacks on the postal system across the state. When you get your ballot, do your research and get it back in. Send it back in early. Yeah. Do not be one of the 727 people who sent in your ballot after Election Day. We have just amazing success here. We've got a great program. And I think it's because of smart investment from the state in voting from home.
Dan, you would have been part of all these votes and appropriations of money to make us a vote-by-mail state and make it happen. Do you want to share any history or insights? I mean, it's fortuitous that we're vote by mail, you know, before a pandemic, like we've got all the structures in place. I'm one of those homes that's received one of those affidavits that my husband's signature didn't match, and we quickly addressed that. Seems to work, Dan?
Yeah, I guess it's interesting for me. So I've grown up kind of all over the world or all over the country, so one way or the other. But when I was in law school, we lived in Oregon, and we went and registered to vote, and your vote, in Oregon, your ballot only comes by mail. And so I got used to it for the 4 years that we lived in Oregon, just voting by mail. And, you know, it kept voting Democrats. So I assumed vote by mail was bad and, you know, horrible and that kind of stuff. But then obviously
love Democrats.
Yeah, I know. So you go to Utah but I came to Utah, and honestly, I was actually fine with vote by mail and thought, okay, this is good, and was wondering why Utah didn't do it already. And you'll remember at the time that we kind of experimented, or we allowed counties to experiment with a vote by mail only option. It was at the same time the count my vote kind of discussion was being had in the state at the same time. And it was a push to try and get greater turnout. And it is clear that having vote by mail does get better turnout. And there is a lot of pluses to it where, you know, people feel like I hear it from constituents all the time. They feel like they can research candidates, they can research issues, they can look about bonding requirements, those kind of things. I changed, you know, the one thing I kept hearing complaints about was, regardless of whether or not they voted in person or voted at home on, you know, in their vote by mail, they were frustrated that they didn't know where to go to get information about judges to vote on. And I hear that quite a bit from constituents. So we actually changed it because most people don't know that there is a nonpartisan judicial rating group that the state, helps put together that's made up of a bunch of lawyers and citizens that review, you know, judicial conduct. And so we put some information on the ballot. So people will see that on the ballot this year that they haven't seen before. I'll just say, Utah, by and large, has been very successful with vote by mail. And I don't necessarily understand the concerns that might be had about other states and their vote by mail process. We're very fortunate in Utah. We have great clerks who have implemented a great process. And the only weakness, and really this goes back to the privacy of ballots, is once the ballot has been separated from the signature, there's no real way to audit or fix or remove. And we've talked about this before. If someone wanted to do a recount and audit those signatures, and they found that some of these signatures shouldn't qualify, well, there would be no way to go back into the ballot system and then pull their ballot out and not have it count. It's really the only weakness that somebody can present to me. But to Shireen's point, there's not a lot of invalidation of stuff by signature. So, I don't get it, but maybe Utah, we've always said the Utah is better than everybody else in the country. So maybe this is just one of those things where we're better.
It feels a little bit that way to me. I did see the irony in President Trump's comments about how the vote by mail absentee ballots work in Florida, that they have a great Republican governor. And the irony being that Florida being the place where we had the Chads on the ballots. And I think it was only a 500 vote kind of difference or something when we had Bush and Gore back in the day. Well, you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We've got a lot more to talk about. Stay tuned for our second segment. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm with Shireen Gourbani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I want to start out this segment, Dan and Shireen, by just talking about the economy for just a minute. I say that because in the last week, we got the second quarter.
Natalie wants to talk about the economy? Wait a second.
We never heard of it.
Shireen, let's sit down because I'm blown away.
We've got the second quarter GDP numbers came out and a peak to trough drop of 11% in the United States. During the Great Recession, the similar number would be 4%. So it's like twice the magnitude. But the reason I wanted to bring it up is that this is going to be an interesting couple of weeks in Utah. We have 83,000 Utahns currently filing unemployment claims. So think of that. So go into 83,000 homes, families, individuals' lives. And they just lost the $600 extra a week they were getting from the CARES Act. So, you know, that be that what it may. But they're still getting their benefits. They just get less. But by mid-August, the job attached now become permanent because, you know, job attached meant that you were going to be recalled back to your employer. And there's a difference in that you have to be actively looking for work. So as I say that, I'm just noting for our listeners that in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a lot of Utahns that start to feel very, very much a change in their economic lives. They'll have to make choices between paying their bills or not, curtailing spending, selling things. We're entering a really interesting phase of the economic stabilization of our state. So quick comments there, Shireen.
Yeah, I'm concerned about hunger. I want to actually take a moment to plug the PEBT. There is a additional benefit for available for families who have school-aged children. Kids who were on free and reduced lunch or qualified for SNAP, previously known as food stamps. There's a program now in Utah. Initially rejected it, but then ultimately took it, which is the right thing to do, that can give families up to an additional $308 per month per child. I'm worried where we're headed with hunger. I will say on that, you can go to, I think it's utah.jobs.gov/PEBT to learn about the pandemic EBT option to help close the gap on hunger. And I continue to be very worried about that. I'm worried about evictions. I'm worried about people moving into a space where they're not going to be able to pay their mortgages.
Dan, I'd love to hear you put a bit of a human face on this as someone who represents a big chunk of our state as a state senator. Do you have families that you're aware of that live paycheck to paycheck in your representation? And what else needs to happen? I mean, I think we need another federal stimulus. And I'm excited for the legislative session in August because I think there's more the state needs to do. But tell us, put a bit of a face on it from your community.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that's really kind of interesting, because if you look at the jobs that were lost or are lost thus far, they're largely in the services industry, those that are people to people. They're the ones that can't adjust. They're the ones, and honestly, those are the ones at those entry level jobs, those are the ones who are the hardest really to kind of fix, because once you're behind on a bunch of payments and checks and costs, and it's impossible to, you know, I am aware of, you know, a few families that are around us who are struggling. And I will tell you, it has been great to see, in a lot of ways, our neighborhood step in to help several. And I think that really is a strong way to improve our communities and continue to see that investment. But I think the federal government is going to see another stimulus, and I think there is going to be the policy argument right now, and you see this over and over, is how much. And, mm-hmm. you know, and where is, what's that fine line between, you know, a hand up, hand out, that kind of conversation, having people make more by being unemployed was obviously very unpopular, you know, and trying to figure that out. So it will be interesting to see where this policy goes from a DC standpoint, but I am convinced something needs to happen because we need to see where the government and everybody else sees from a public health standpoint that, you know, we need these investments.
And I think this is where Utah actually has so many opportunities. I think because we do have more stability than other states have had. And I think that because we have a smaller population than we're looking at in some of these other places, we really could get creative. And I think we could fill some important gaps and really create a better sense of stability for people who might be, especially around housing. I'm certainly a person who believes that housing is healthcare, and that when people have stable housing, we see so many other elements of their lives stabilize. There's a lot that we could do in that space, and I hope that's on the table in this next session.
Shireen, as you mentioned, that the other strength of Utah is that we can still solve problems. There's enough unity, enough compromise, enough give and take that we're able to still solve problems. That's the spirit of both sides of the aisle, by the way. I want to transition also to some very important news that happened this week. It came out of our capital city mayor, Erin Mendenhall. She announced police reforms, stricter rules on body cams, a required protocol of de-escalation, extra review when there's been use of force. But really, the one that I liked the most was her thought about a duty to intervene. And that's one of the most frustrating things to me of the George Floyd, because you have, you know, a bad actor. But I wanted police officers to know that they can call out their colleagues. Dan, did you follow Mayor Mendenhall's reforms? And they're quick. They have to be implemented by September 5th. I feel like she's on her game.
You know, I actually texted Mayor Mendenhall and thanked her for taking some of those positive steps. And she is, in a lot of ways, leading the country on some of these issues. It's interesting, too, because, you know, that idea, what you talked about, Natalie, the idea, and this is something for those of you that don't know on the show, you know, I am one of the more civil liberties minded Republicans, maybe is the best way to say it, and have worked closely with, you know, the ACLU, have worked closely with even with the police departments to try and get reform and to get greater transparency within our law enforcement. And so the body cams issue actually is something that was in a bill that I ran a few years ago. And, you know, law enforcement refused really to accept that kind of measure. And to see the mayor taking that step is in some ways, I think, is positive. And the other thing I think is that really comes out of this is, you know, in the George Floyd situation, you had other officers around, and I'm certain we will hear their testimony as well when that trial comes around. But it will be interesting to know the officer's thinking in that process, because there's, I think, when you see something like that as an officer, it puts you in a tough situation. Like if a colleague is way outside of the bounds or doing something inappropriate, illegal, or harmful, how do you react and what do you do? You know,
and I think in that case,
duty to intervene.
I think in that case, there were two that had been on the job for a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
How do you question a superior officer? How do you, you know,
it has to be part of the culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. Yeah. And so this ability is a big change you mentioned, Natalie.
Yeah, I think that there are some really good reforms here. I think it's a good step. I do think people are looking for more. And there are actually really, there have been a number of good policy suggestions coming forward in this space. Libertas has actually some of these and more that they have offered in addition to the work that they'd already been doing in this space. And then we, of course, have the ACLU, which has come forward with a number of recommendations. And then some things that do have to happen at the state level. So I feel like what you're saying, Dan, is that if people are looking for reform in this space, that they should start tweeting at you.
I am already involved in those conversations.
Yeah.
You know, I have a number of constituents who are law enforcement officers, and I have a number of constituents who feel as much as I do, which is in a lot of ways, I agree with some of the components of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? I kind of stop when it comes to like lighting cars on fire and like, you know,
they wouldn't say that's part of the movement.
Yeah. And I would agree with them, but I would say that is something systemic in our justice system, and,
yes.
and riding this ship would be very, very helpful. And I think that, but there's gotta be a way, Shireen and Natalie, the same way that we don't remove police from the process, because they're absolutely essential in protecting many basic safety functions.
Yeah. I'm going to make a comparison here that'll probably get me in trouble, but you know, I'm a big jazz fan, attend a lot of jazz games. I've always admired the way the Salt Lake PD handles crowds, what they do. They just seem so incredibly competent and kind. I mean, I think it's a very well-run police department. When Real Salt Lake put their stadium in Sandy, this is the part that'll get me in trouble. I was so disappointed with the way they handled crowds after games as you cross State Street with children in tow and, you know, the police not there to help protect safety and whatnot. Anyway, I bring that up as to mention that what on earth was going on in Cottonwood Heights on Sunday in this environment, speaking about culture, Shireen, for there to be the kind of flare-up that was allowed or that was promoted there, let these people have their voice.
Yeah.
I just thought that, you know, that the first thing I saw was a tweet from Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune where he says something's going down in Cottonwood Heights, and it's like, what?
Yeah, that reaction was completely unwarranted, and I feel like there has been quite a call for an investigation, understanding what's happening. But I think this is actually in part to sort of a larger point here. The changes that are made in Salt Lake City that we're starting to see are good, but it's simply not enough. There has to be consistency across, especially our county, when we see that different jurisdictions are responding to often the same events. And so having everyone on the same page when it comes to these reforms is really important to me. So I'm hoping that we have the energy and the decision-making to pull in other police departments, other municipalities, many who have their own police, and that's what is going on in Cottonwood Heights. And I'll just add that Councilwoman Tali Bruce has had a number of incidents of harassment from the chief of police in Cottonwood Heights. It's been well documented in our local press. There's a problem with the reaction that happened in that space. And I want to be clear, too. I've been out with these protesters, this specific protest that moves through the streets, dancing, drawing awareness to an issue. They're on a block for a few minutes and they move on. It is not at all what I think it was painted to be, and I think that deserves a full investigation.
Hmm. Dan, you have a lot of political expertise. You do as well, Shireen, but I'm starting with Dan because I want to ask a House legislative question. Election season's upon us. Labor Day will be just around the corner, and it's looking like the Democrats think they might win a few more House races this election. The one that is particularly vulnerable is Representative Eric Hutchins. Hutchins is someone that I've worked with quite a bit on the Olympics and does a really nice job, but he won by just 118 votes last time. He's got a challenger, maybe Shireen, you know her, it's Democrat Ashley Matthews. She's a UDOT employee, if I've got that right. Mm-hmm. But give us a quick preview, Dan, of what you're seeing in the sort of election environment and the legislature as we move towards Labor Day, and then Shireen will get your comment.
There's always this unfounded hope of the Democrats in Utah that this is the year for massive change, new people elected, and let's start these stories early and often and use them for fundraising. Eric Hutchins is going to be fine. It's a presidential year. There tend to be, when you look at presidential election years, there tends to be a better turnout for Republicans than there are other parts of the state. So I think Eric's going to be fine. That said, Eric is and has been a long time, you know, long serving member of the legislature. I think he might be the longest active serving member in the House currently.
Former Democrat.
And as a result, and former Democrat, right? Which I encourage everyone who's a Democrat to be a former Democrat, by the way. But I would say that you know, Eric is, you know, when you've served long enough, people aim at you. That's where he's at.
I think
it's disappointing because he's great bipartisan. He's a great bipartisan guy.
Yeah. And obviously we could stand to have, you know, more people who are interested in that engagement and working across the aisle. But I think that there's a real sentiment of just feeling looking for greater accountability, and greater accountability in our state legislature can come with greater balance. So I encourage everyone to look at both your candidates, do your research and see if it's time for a change.
We've got about 45 seconds left on the program. So, Dan, your quick parting thoughts, either a gripe or gratitude, and then we'll go to Shireen and I'll have something to say as well.
I'm just going to say one thing I noticed this last week is I saw people on both sides of the aisle complaining about Dr. Fauci. And then I also saw people complimenting Dr. Fauci from both sides of the aisle. He is this polarizing figure that none of them can figure out what to do with. And that's actually kind of a fun spot to be in. I can appreciate that.
Shireen?
So I would just, again, encourage people to share the news about the PEBT. I am always, you know, thinking about our families that may be experiencing hunger and what we can do to reduce that. If you know anyone, or if you, you can jump on my website, share the story. KSL does a story about it. Just, you don't know who in your network is hungry.
We'll leave it at that. I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Dan McKay, Shireen Gourbani, thanks so much. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Stay safe, everyone.